we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
So over the weekend, as I was sitting in my backyard, actually playing with my children, a news flash came across the news wire. It said President Biden, who 4 days ago, I would remind you, had conquered because of his double vaccination and double boosted status, had conquered COVID-19 and was released from isolation. It was 4 days later, this past Saturday, that Biden, our president, has got COVID again within 4 days. Again, I would call this in some ways a reinfection, but it is interesting that he tested negative 4 days previous and now he's testing positive again. This was to be expected by anybody that understood the data on Paxlovid. But the funny thing is, the news, as well as I guess they're basically our elected Pfizer reps at the White House, continue to push a drug and state its low reinfection rate based on its clinical trial data, that it is exceedingly rare that this would happen. The problem is the clinical trial data, which again looks at a subset of people that usually are young and healthy, but in this case, most importantly, are unvaccinated and had never had COVID. So again, the exclusion criteria for this trial was that you were not allowed in it if you had been even vaccinated once, much less four times, but also had never had COVID. So again, I'm not really sure how we continue to state in President Biden's case that this is rare, but three federal officials have taken Paxlovid: Becerra, Fauci, Biden. All three have had reinfection, and at least two of them, I'm not really sure what they're going to do with President Biden, but the first two took a second course, which, by the way, is off-label and was not recommended by the FDA, nor was it recommended by Fauci, despite the fact that when he had COVID rebound, he took it. So that's kind of what we're going to discuss for the first part of today. So I will bring in Stuart Tankersley. Again, this is Concerned Doctors on America Out Loud Pulse, always one beat ahead. But we are here today for our weekly show and to continue to inform you about the current medical environment, the current patient environment, and really to expose a lot of the duplicity that is going on from our administrative authorities. Stuart, what do you think about Saturday being updated that the president, who had vanquished the COVID-19 so easily because he was quadruple vaccinated, evidently got it again so quickly.
Yeah, and I do want to welcome the audience and once again tell them our prayers and thoughts are with the president and his quick recovery, we hope. But the duplicity is, I wonder how they can sleep at night when they can't, when they're using a drug off label like this, especially one that's not been proven with 4 billion doses, like something like ivermectin. By the way, you know that the ivermectin has 20 plus mechanisms of action against COVID and this virus and the inflammation it causes. And also the long haulers of people that have been received the vaccine that have spikeopathy. That's the spike protein that's causing so much damage. But the protease inhibition that it affords over that of Paxlovid, the binding of ivermectin at the site of, so that it blocks replication, if you will, it blocks the virus from multiplying, is stronger. The affinity of ivermectin is stronger at that phase of the replication cycle than that of Paxlovid. But once again, they're not making $530 or $550 a round of treatment for it. So it's, of course, dismissed. And it would, of course, we have to admit, be off-label usage. Well, just like Paxlovid is being used off-label with Dr. Fauci. And I think it's important.
Okay. If you look at the trial data, you actually, I mean, typically how, again, as a physician, how a lot of these trials work is they will test it in a population. That population is usually the most likely to benefit from it, which is interesting because most of these vaccines, as well as these interventions, Paxlovid, Remdesivir, they have all been tested. I'll take back, Remdesivir probably, the trial itself didn't actually show any improvement. So it was a pretty, they actually tested it in the proper people. But Paxlovid, again, was tested in a population that was neither vaccinated nor had COVID. It probably goes on to explain why the course of treatment's only 5 days, because we know that in the unvaccinated, the viral replication or presence of virus to be cultured in the nose of an individual is usually only there for 5 days or less. This summer, there was some interesting data that was presented by the New England Journal that showed the vaccinated, it's there for 10, and the boosted is it's there for 15. So again, in medical literature, as well as data that we have from trials, you can only go as far as the people you include in these trials. And you can definitely not make any assumptions on those that were excluded. And Biden is an example. Fauci is an example. Becerra is an example of people that if they wanted to get in the original trial would have been excluded. Therefore, in the way that the FDA usually works, that would be considered off-label use to begin with. Correct?
Right. Yeah. Exactly, Jordan. I think that a lot of this, it's very interesting to me how the media wraps itself in pretzels perpetually. They are continuously, it's like a DNA, the helix, if you will, because there was an article written on June the 19th, on Saturday, in The Atlantic, which is a very establishment propaganda mouthpiece. And they ask, they make a lot of assertions and ask some questions that it seems reasonable. Some of the questions they ask, several of the responses they get from their experts seem bizarre, and their conclusion is really bizarre. And I think it, behoove people that want to just simply look at this and know the evidence to say, maybe this is a good example. I can get off of this suicide train I'm on and get on a different perspective, because like any media outlet, they're asking important questions, but their presuppositions going into it just simply don't make any sense. And so they start out early in the article saying, and they're quoting a Yale doctor, and she was saying she's feeling a sense of resignation because it's only one of the few treatments available. And then the UCF, University of California, San Francisco chair of medicine is quoted, and he makes the statement, it's a complicated 3D chess game because of limited data available. And that's one of the amazing things about that is continuously occurring in throughout this catastrophe called COVID, because there is no forthcoming. They're never forthcoming. They're never transparent with this data. And I want to talk about that later, Jordan, because of the FOIA request that came out a week or two ago. But the ongoing collection of data remains confidential. They say that in the article. And this is
Not only that, I think that UCSF doctor, he says he can barely figure out if he should take it. If a medicine physician himself can't decide whether they should take it or not, I don't know how they live with themselves by telling other people to take it.
Well, you know, this is an example of the insanity of the last 2 years. I'm just going to go on a rabbit trail here and remind, in our state, one of the most prominent infectious disease experts in the world was got sick. This was back in, I think, April of 2020. And he took hydroxychloroquine, and thank goodness he got better. And Jordan and I have respect for this doctor. Clearly, he's been wrong on COVID, like several others. But he took the hydroxychloroquine, and he got better, thank goodness. And unfortunately, he wrote a really odd apology letter in our paper, our state paper, one of our state papers, AL.com. And he apologized for taking it. Now, Jordan, I've been in practice for over 20 years, and I have never heard of a patient have a problem, take a medication, not have any adverse events, get over the problem, and then complain to me that they took the medicine.
Yeah, I guess otherwise, other than if it was marijuana, cocaine, or something like that,
right.
those are cures for other things, but they happen to be drugs that aren't readily available. So yes, I would agree. Outside of the drug abusing doctor, who is right. Definitely getting results from what he was doing, right. He wasn't allowed to take them. But no, not for a safe medicine, right. Especially in the class of medicines that they use all the time. I mean, this is an infectious right. disease doctor that knows right. hydroxychloroquine, probably prescribes it all the time in a travel clinic, knows it's safe. So again, he's pretty knowledgeable about the drug, took it himself. And the only reason I can surmise that he apologized was political. It had nothing to do with health.
Right, right. Yeah, clearly. And here we are with this doctor from the well-respected University of California, San Francisco, the chair of medicine. It's amazing how they're not able to see the nose right in the nose on their face. I mean, it's just amazing. The pandemic is simply moving too quickly. The virus is evolving too fast, and our responses to it are changing too often for anyone to find unambiguous answers about one specific drug.
And by the way, Stuart, I think we should addendum that sentence and say one specific vaccine, yet you're not allowed to say that. So you could say the same sentence that they just said. Pandemic is simply moving too quickly. Virus is evolving too fast. And responses is changing too often to find unambiguous answers about one specific vaccine. Same kind of thing. Again, the whole reason that we don't have a history of actually developing good vaccines for RNA viruses is they simply move too quickly and evolve too fast.
And historical evidence, epidemiological, vaccinology evidence is you do not vaccinate out of a pandemic like we have been doing. Unbelievable. And we can talk about that another time. But here is one of the amazing statements that they assert. Paxlovid's safety profile is stellar. They are still maintaining that about the vaccines as well, are they not, Jordan? And so it's amazing that, once again, they just ignore the obvious because the safety profile is stellar. And Jordan, you know, one of the things we must remind people, and we want to get them to get their doctors to listen to us because, you know, they're not hearing the truth about COVID because of the Truth Initiative, the Trusted News Initiative, I mean. But
well, I will say, you know, the UCSF doctor up there, he got in trouble for stating that he was unsure whether his son, who was in his 20s, should be vaccinated based on the risk. So he's definitely a rebel, but not a rebel compared to people who actually are being truthful. But this guy at least is a little bit thinking outside of the mainstream protocol that's been jabbed down everybody else's face. So So I did actually respect him. Now he did have to go back and kind of tool what he had said because he's pretty active on Twitter, and that was one of the things that he said about 11 months ago, that his son, given he's a healthy, athletic 20-year-old, he's unsure whether he would recommend the vaccine to him or not, which just to say that is enough to get you banned.
Right. No question. Obviously, several have been banned, like several that we listen to frequently. But anyway, so Paxlovid has a stellar profile. Okay, well, none of them have been, once again, earlier in the article in The Atlantic, they're saying that the data remains confidential, yet it's a stellar profile. No one died while taking, this is a really odd assertion. You just never hear doctors talking like this. He said, or one of the doctors they quoted in the article said, no one died while taking it in Pfizer's clinical trials, period. Got it? Question mark. Good. Explanation mark. Well, that kind of assertion is just really, it's, we didn't, I don't ever recall seeing that from highly esteemed medical professionals before 2020, but dadgummit, these times are crazy.
And you're talking about a trial that is, you know, again, you know, deaths in trials are very rare. And if there is deaths, usually the trial, I mean, definitely the medicine wouldn't have come to market, because you're talking about such a small subset of people that you really don't find out about its true, what I would call pharmacovigilance until you roll it out to a larger population. Because, you know, 1 in 10,000 deaths is still significant, especially if you're talking about a drug that you're writing 40,000 doses of it a day. Okay. No. So again, that's four people. If you had a 1 in 10,000 chance of having an adverse event that resulted in death, which is fairly low, but it's still, when you roll it out to the whole country, is a whole different ballgame.
Right. But the three times I wrote for it in January, including with a family member, I wrote it for three patients. None of the three could complete the 5 days of treatment because of side effects. And two of them were hallucinations. Now, I was obligated to reporting it into the adverse event system, and I will remind patients to remind their doctors, by law, on the vaccines, if you give the vaccine and someone has a reaction to it, they by law must report that into the VAERS system. But a doctor should, and so, but a patient can. But by law, the doctor has to report it in there, unless they've, of course, tweaked the rules again in the last year. But one of the statements was, and so when I tried to report those three, the system wouldn't allow me to. And I asked our state health officer, and he couldn't help me with that. But anyways, going further in this paper, in this article in The Atlantic, Pfizer's trials found no statistically significant effect on hospitalization among a group of vaccinated with low risk from the disease and vaccinated at high risk. I thought that was an amazing statement. The duplicity, the lack of transparency is just amazing in this whole thing. And Pfizer isn't testing it yet on those that are immunocompromised. Those are the people most at risk from having a bad outcome from COVID. Very interesting statement.
Which is similar to the vaccines, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
again, it's like we're going to test it in this population that has nothing to do with the population we recommend it in. Is a unique take in medicine that is crazy that they're getting away with it on a daily basis. So,
and I'll close the first session this morning with, or this afternoon with, with the final paragraph of this interesting article from The Atlantic. In the meantime, patients and providers are muddling through. All of the doctors I spoke with said that they're still erring on the side of prescribing Paxlovid thanks to its lack of debilitating side effects. Sheehan, though not a medical doctor, was recently a Paxlovid patient when he came down with COVID after traveling. I ended up on the medication within 48 hours after the onset of symptoms and was antigen negative in 9 days, and it never came back. He said when he spoke last week, 5 days later, he emailed me to say that he had tested positive again. That's how this long article ends.
Exactly. And again, it goes back to the fact that these vaccines are creating people that are persistently infectious for much longer than they would be if they're unvaccinated. And that's a classic example of a concern for the development of antibody-dependent enhancement of disease. So, because it's kind of one of the first steps, persistence of viremia is not a good thing when it comes to an infection. So,
well, the wonderful thing is this is an indication of the desperation that the author just makes no sense throughout the article. She can't understand why in the world things aren't turning out like they were hoping. And it's ignoring the evidence. They just can't seem to get a handle on it.
In 2008, the amount of concentrated time people could spend on a task without becoming distracted was 12 seconds. 5 years later, it was only 8 seconds, 1 second less than a goldfish. If you find yourself always distracted or having trouble recalling information, you're likely to fall behind in the demanding, fast-paced 21st century. In other words, brain performance is more critical now than ever. Boost your brain power with Healthy Cells Focus Plus Recall. Science-backed nootropics to sharpen focus, concentrate longer, enhance recall, improve mental speed, learn rapidly, and be more alert. It's a pill-free brain supplement made with maximum absorption technology, designed to feed our brains at the cellular level. Take it for a test drive. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Focus Plus Recall. That's HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
All right, you've all heard Malcolm and the great Dr. Peter McCullough talk about the povidone iodine-based nasal spray Cofix RX. They talk about it because it's a product that actually works in combating colds, flus, and coronaviruses. Cofix is made in the USA and recommended by thousands of doctors and pharmacists nationwide. It's simple. By attacking viruses where they incubate, you make it easier for your body to heal. Check out the Cofix RX banner ad on AmericaOutLoud.com and save 20% by using promo code OUTLOUD.
Welcome back. Thank you for joining us. And we would encourage you to tell your friends, but most importantly, let's encourage you today to tell your doctors about our podcast, because we're talking about something that I think the large majority of them simply do not know about. What they don't have the understanding about what the dangers of these vaccines are and the lack of treatment of the disease, but also the lack of treatment of long haulers. Jordan, I think the best term we can encourage those listeners out there to ask their doctor is, have you ever heard of spikeopathy? Spikeopathy is the core issue in COVID. The spike protein of the 29 proteins on this virus is pathogenic. It causes disease. And we've known this. I think Dr. Yodin was the head of Pfizer's respiratory division, made this statement in 2008. But we have known that of the 29, there is only one protein on this virus that causes disease by itself. And yet, despite that, it was the chosen protein for this vaccine. And unfortunately, we are wreaking the damage in unparalleled ways from this spike protein. And so the term is spikeopathy, the disease caused by the spike protein. And that's what we would encourage, as we discuss here, encourage your doctors to listen to this segment of our broadcast.
You know, one of the other ways to ask him without is just say, why is COVID so dangerous? And the problem is most of them will have to come up with the answer that Stuart just said in a different way. Well, this spike protein causes a lot of damage. Okay. And so that's basically what spikeopathy, what we're talking about. It's the S1, and it's really this S1 subunit of the spike protein, which is kind of the top part that really causes damage. interestingly enough, the virus itself is damaging, but the actual vaccine utilizes a technology that was patented in 2016. We just actually licensed it to the rest of the world. It was created by some government officials, and it is called the Spike Protein Stabilization Technology. So again, it is the spike S1 subunits of the spike protein is damaging, and we are creating a technology to stabilize it in vivo or inside a human. Doesn't sound to me, Stuart, like that seems to be a rational response or way to deal with the pathogen, is to make it more effective and less likely to break down in the body.
I hope that people, whoever was involved with this, will be found guilty before the law, and hopefully there will be one. There will be a Nuremberg-like investigation into this, because this has been so devastating for the world in many ways. And what's so interesting, and sorry for getting to if this is, and it should, I guess, in a way, get a go above your head, but I want to just insert about a 15-second point to make to the doctors that are listening. The engineered spike protein, there was a stabilizing amino acid that was used that is not natural to us, and it extended the life of the messenger RNA. And that's what's causing, that is believed to be one of the main reasons that this protein, spike protein that was engineered clearly, that's what's causing a lot of the damage. So sorry to go into the weeds on that. If you would please forgive me. But the point is that this is an engineered virus, and we're using it in a platform that is so dangerous, unproven on these vaccines, that somebody needs to be held to account because of the damages done by this. It is so unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. And so ask your doctors, what is spikeopathy? What is going on with this virus? Of course, any virus which infects by itself is going to cause problems. But if you just look at one protein on this virus, it is toxic to the body, the human body.
And that was, you know, again, we had a meeting of a bunch of medical professionals Thursday night, and I was given a little talk about kind of long COVID, microclots, vaccine injury. And one of the kind of, I think the basic reason that our medical profession has been so bad at responding to this is because I look at it in a way as if what doctors are really good at is listening to your symptoms, listening to your issues, and then going back and kind of fitting you into a script of diseases that they know and understand. And the biggest problem with the current medical system and its response to COVID is they've been told that coronavirus disease is a viral pneumonia and may have kind of a septic end in the hospital, but it really isn't. It is it's much different than any disease we've ever seen. It's what we would call a new disease. And that's one of the reasons that the academic and administrative community was so hard on trying to do some crazy stuff, because this disease had such deleterious and unique effects. The problem is they've seemed to have forgotten that and are now treating every person that walks into the clinic and try to fit them into, whether it's they've got chest pain, they must have coronary disease, or they've got shortness of breath, they must have asthma. But in reality, they just had COVID, or they just had a vaccine plus a booster, and the spike protein itself can cause many symptoms, especially vascular symptoms. And without that knowledge, they are going to misdiagnose what's going on every time. So we've got to get the doctors back to where they understand, first of all, this is a new disease, so therefore you need to learn the new stuff about it. Second of all, putting a box around a disease that has only really been out there for a little over a year is really one of the dumbest things we can do as physicians. It's probably not smart to put a box around a disease that's 50 years old. I mean, again, there's protocols and stuff, but We understand that disease to an extent, but it doesn't mean that we have to put a box that's so solid around it that we can't rethink it, whether it's, you know, reflux disease in the 90s to cancer in the last 20 years using immunological medicines. You know, rethinking it and having an open mind is important. But I will say, if a disease is completely new, an open mind and always thinking about possibilities is of utmost importance and actually probably foundational.
No question. I heard you say that during that important talk Thursday night, and I thought that's a beautiful way of saying it. Putting yourself in a box, especially in a new situation, it really goes to the understanding or motivations, understanding of why you became a doctor. The physicians usually are the brightest in the class that they were raised in and things like that. But unfortunately, our training in the past generation or more has trapped us into you must follow the dictates, not you must learn how to think. Because that is a beautiful way of saying it. You don't want to put yourself in a box in medicine, but especially when you're encountering a new disease process. You've got to step away from the box. Don't be intimidated. I am so embarrassed by our profession coming up in the last year with this crazy term called sudden adult death syndrome. We've just, a young athlete on the court or on the field of play just dropping dead, and we're just going to assign them this nebulous, meaningless adult death syndrome. That is such an embarrassment. It's an indictment of our profession. So we would encourage everyone, think outside the box because this is new. Spikeopathy is real. The evidence is abundant. And an example of that is, I think, we've known for decades that natural immunity works. Natural immunity works. And it's definitely been enough. It's over 200 trials now that it's shown to be more beneficial, more protective than these vaccines. Well, why is that? Well, this, once again, I mentioned earlier that this virus is made of 29 proteins. When you get infected with that, your body develops antibodies to all of those, especially those 7 that are on the surface that it gets exposed to the most. Yet we're trying to force ourselves into believing it's just the sad situation of our culture that this vaccine that produces immunity to one part of this virus, the spike protein, is the answer. It just doesn't make common sense.
And only that, it goes back to the fact that when you talk about the S1 subunit of the spike protein does all this bad stuff, and guess what the vaccine makes you make? A stabilized form of it. And while it's really giving a bad name to vaccines because, you know, when we talk about vaccines in the past, you might read things like inactivated viral vaccine or, those words inactivated. And they're basically kind of pseudonyms for getting rid of the thing that causes the most damage and letting the body be exposed to the thing that's not damaging so it fights it off. The problem is in this virus, we did the opposite. We not only utilized the most toxic part of the virus, we also didn't let you passively interface with it. We made your own cells make it. And that is fundamentally, first of all, unique. We've never done that before. Second of all, incredibly dangerous. And that's the reason that there wasn't a past of good safety data on this technology. And it's one of the reasons I think that we're seeing so much excess death within vaccinated communities and developed countries using the mRNA vaccines.
Yeah. So, Jordan, let's go just for the next several minutes over what we're talking about in particular with spikeopathy. Spike protein, once again, the only protein on this virus that by itself is toxic to the human body. And this spike protein is adversely affects us in several ways, whether it is direct neuron damage or direct heart muscle damage or direct damage to the inside lining of our arteries. It just has so many profound, unfortunate mechanisms of hurting us. Let's just give a quick rundown as to your understanding, for example, on what it does to the endothelium, the lining of the arteries, if you will.
Yeah, so we know that the S1 subunit, the spike protein, first of all, in platelet-poor plasma, which would mean we spin down your blood or anybody's blood, and drop that spike subunit into that plasma, which is your spun down blood, take away your red blood cells, it will start making fibrin chains. And it makes fibrin chains in a way that are difficult. So it makes fibrin that is resistant to fibrinolysis. And so we've never seen this before. In fact, we might see some fibrin chains that are resistant to fibrinolysis in years of chronic disease states like diabetes or significant coronary disease, but nothing that's ever literally not even needed the addition of thrombin, which is what your body usually requires to make fibrin chains. But this spike protein by itself can do it. It's almost like a prion-like reaction where a protein is making another protein conform into something without some type of enzymatic reaction. And that's dangerous. We also know that at the endothelial level, it causes mast cells as well as platelets and other coagulation factors to attach to those endothelial cells and basically cause an ongoing inflammatory reaction, releasing lots of nasty interleukins. And interleukins are basically chemical signals between white blood cells and your immune system that really tell the body to attack. And in this case, the interleukins that are released are the ones that tell the body to almost go nuclear. And that is what makes this spike protein by itself so dangerous.
Yes. That's why it's interesting, the evidence we have. For example, I think the evidence is clear now that as much as it can be this early in this disease process, that in long haulers, people that it's a spikeopathy, people that have been infected. Now, if you get infected with SARS-2 and you develop COVID, the large majority of people that develop long haulers have had COVID. They've just not been infected. So it gives you an indication that's the amount of spike protein that their body has had to fight off. This is a natural infection I'm referring to. But then when the amount of spike protein that somebody has to deal with after the vaccine is, or after the inoculation is given to them, once again, we've gone over it before, but the vaccine is an inappropriate term for this technology. But if you have received one of these inoculations or two of these or three of them, your body is producing much more messenger RNA, spike protein from the messenger RNA. Your body is producing much more than if you just merely got infected by it. So your body's having to deal with a lot more spike protein that we know hangs out in certain cells, immune cells, has been found 14, 15 months later. And unfortunately, we are suspecting that a year from now, you can just add another 12 months to that timeline. But then you have to fight off more and more and more.
And as McCullough had a paper looking at the confirmation of the difference between an actual natural infection spike protein and an mRNA elicited spike protein, and they are significantly different. Again, the spike protein stabilization technology was used to make that spike protein harder to break down. Okay. It's not a good thing. And not only that, the mRNA sequence is different, whether it's the Pfizer or the Moderna. And his paper actually showed that there's significant difference, and those significant differences have the effect of making it harder to break down. So you're at more of an even, again, goes to the point that the vaccine may actually cause more injury than the actual infection in terms of its spikeopathy perspective.
Right. And I want to make a point to the physicians who are maybe learning for the first time about this. The messenger RNA that is utilized in the vaccine or in the inoculations, those are longer lasting because of the pseudouridine that's in them. That's one of the amino acids. That's a manufactured, man-made immunization technology. That lasts longer than the natural messenger RNA because of that. That was the whole point of it, the way they designed it. And then it gets put into the muscles, into the cells, and then the cells make a spike protein that is different, that hangs around longer. So it's not only the protein that is produced because of the inoculation, but it is the messenger RNA itself, and both of them hang around longer in our body. Sorry to get into the weeds for you, but I think it's important for the doctors to get outside the box and look at the science, look at the evidence of what we're talking about, because spikeopathy is key.
And all right, well, we will take a break. We will come back and we will be talking about some interesting developments in the FOIA request for Dr. Fauci's emails, and in addition, some other kind of developments in the regulatory world. Actually, one of them a victory this weekend. But again, this is Dr. Jordan Vaughn, Dr. Stuart Tankersley, and this is America Out Loud Pulse. We are always one beat ahead.
Here on America Out Loud, we emphasize optimal health, and air is the most essential element for life. The average person inhales over 35 pounds of air every day, yet we seldom think about how to rid the air of pathogens swiftly and safely when we need to. The Genesis Fogger Plus HOCL is the only way to quickly and naturally restore air to its optimal condition. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud for a free ebook on everything you need to know about HOCL and receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next.
Now the spirit of American liberty and justice is woven into the soul of America Out Loud. Now we invite you, friends, to invest some of your time with our magnificent family of experts, their minds and voices. It's all back at AmericaOutLoud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
A headline over the weekend read as this: healthcare workers settle COVID shot mandate for $10.3 million. For a lot of you, this is probably the first time you've heard of a victory at the level of COVID mandates. But it is an interesting victory, and it is probably only the tip of the iceberg. Amazingly, it was just a settlement, meaning that the hospital knew that if they were to continue in the legal system, the likelihood is that their payout would have been much larger, because again, we were talking about fundamental rights that we have under the Constitution. And the defense that the hospital may have that says, well, the NIH said this, or Dr. Fauci said that, or President Biden said this. The problem is we have the rules that our bodies and our rights are abiding by. It's called the Constitution. And it doesn't matter what or when or who said something. Those rules don't change. And it was a great day for the Constitution and people's rights to be able to practice their religion and also avoid any medical experimentation. And that no company and no private party or no government agency can force those away just because an emergency has been declared. So, Stuart, what did you think about that?
I think it is I agree. It's the tip of the iceberg. Good Lord willing, more and more of these cases are going to be won for the benefit of so many millions. Coercion in any drug study is unethical. It is immoral, and up until the last year or two, it has been illegal. And hopefully they're going to reestablish that illegality with cases that are coming forward more and more like this. Remember, and Jordan, I think we ought to attach to the bottom of our podcast today the link to a wonderful 10-page, there's a 10-page informed consent that a website has put together that goes through the evidence. An informed consent statement is essential because we were all made in God's image. As such, we have rights and responsibilities for that. As a result of that, that's fundamentally why we have the need for informed consent. If we're going to be experimented on, we need to have the understanding of what risks we are taking. And it's only right, it's only just, it's only moral that we have that informed consent. That has been missing, for the past year and a half. And it's and they knew this when the vaccines were rolled out. When I was on the vaccine working group, that question was put forward time and again. When are we going to see the informed consent statement? Oh, we're waiting on it. We're waiting on it. Well, thank goodness somebody has done the effort, has gone through the effort and put together a 10-page informed consent statement that clearly lays out, if you know this, if you know that about these vaccines and the dangers. Of course, the government won't give it to us. We have to beg and plead for it because they've rejected their responsibility of oversight. But if we will simply read an informed consent, I doubt anybody in our country, much less a parent that loves their six-month-old, would ever give these vaccines or inoculations. But I hope and pray that this will put the nail in the coffin of these things, because they have put too many people in the coffin already.
Yeah, it's and again, I mean, we're talking about 500 people resulting in $10 million. I think texted some of my legislators when I looked at this and said, is the Alabama Hospital Association ready for this? Because I don't think this is going away. As the fog of the pandemic goes away and we are reminded of what has been done in the name of health, there is going to be people paying. And some people pay with money. I will say there's a new BBC article that says COVID-19 disruptions killed 228,000 children in South Asia. So, again, some people paid with their lives. So a lot of what we have to understand is that these small momentary things that people think are unimportant are, first of all, have secondary effects. Third, when it violates somebody's rights, it doesn't matter if you don't think that their rights are important. It's not your job to evaluate that.
Yeah, and not only did they ignore that responsibility of getting informed consent and coercing people in any way, their employees to get the inoculation, they went into the data system that our state has. This is what I was so proud of our attorney general in our state. He wrote a cease and desist order less than a year ago when it was discovered that these hospital systems went into the state website and determined which of their employees had gotten, who had taken these inoculations. That is such an egregious abuse, not only in coercing people with threat of their job, but then going into the government system to mine their employees. That's personal protected health information. And they went in and mined that data. Once again, it's just an indication of how far off the rails we've been in this culture when it looks at rights, fundamental rights of people. And it's just bewildering that they would have even considered that. And I hope we come, I hope they come out. And this, I think, will help us get over these types of actions.
Well,
we need to point out the individuals responsible, not just the systems, but the individuals responsible for these crazy decisions.
Well, speaking of individuals and finding out, Judicial Watch this week had an update on their FOIA request for emails that Christine Grady, that referenced COVID-19 vaccine, antibody enhancement, childhood trials. They again updated that they are continuing to be blocked from their FOIA requests. So lawfully, these emails should be released. I will also go on to tell you that they also want all emails sent between Christine Grady and Anthony Fauci. And I will go on to remind our audience that these two, in the eyes of the law, are husband and wife, which should worry you as well. So who Christine Grady is the National Institutes of Health Chief of Clinical Center's Department of Bioethics. So if you wonder why it seems like so many ethical basic understandings of what is experimentation, what is able to be done in a Western view of medicine, and especially post-World War II and Nuremberg trials, the commitment to informing and getting consent of patients before they are involved in treatments. If you're wondering why a lot of that was so quickly thrown away, unfortunately, it might have to do with the fact that the individual responsible for making sure that happens is married to the person that wanted it to happen. And I'm not saying for sure, but it seems like a conflict of interest, Stuart, wouldn't you say?
I think you're right. I think it's important to understand that in a legal setting, if somebody is trying to, if a spouse is on trial, the other side can't present as a witness the spouse, unless they're willing to, because the spouse is of one flesh with their spouse. The husband is of one flesh with the wife. So if the husband's on trial, the wife is not compelled to be on trial. But that is different. This is about public policy. And so their records, their communiques through their phone, through their emails, is public record. And why they haven't turned over this to Judicial Watch is, I can't say I'm surprised, but it is a travesty. It's just, it's a sign of the times. I also want to, talking about our fearless leaders, on June 23rd of this year, the CDC director, Dr. Walensky, said that the COVID-19 vaccinations have undergone and continue to undergo the most intensive safety monitoring in U.S. history. Well, I wish we could trust her, but unfortunately, she once again is not being faithful to her duties. She's not being completely above board. She's not really being above board at all, because a FOIA request, another FOIA request, has been seeking to gain access to the records of the VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. The VAERS system is trying, when they laid out the vaccine, they swore to us that they would do an extensive, very frequent update of the vaccines. And a FOIA request in the last couple of weeks has revealed, in fact, they have not done any. So it's an odd statement that she would swear to us just 5 or 6 weeks ago that it is the most intensive safety monitoring in U.S. history. Yet, in fact, they now admit they've never been doing any monitoring of this at all. And obviously, if they had, they would have shut this down within the first month.
Stuart, again, I hope she's lying, as opposed to this is how they do it usually.
Yeah,
that would be even more concerning.
So. No, I think the last generation, the bureaucrats that have been running our lives and ruining a lot of lives, have not been held to account, and this is probably standard operating procedure. On an optimistic note, Jordan, at the end of last week, I found out, I read an article that the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, AAPS, what a wonderful organization. Dr. Jane Orient has been running that for years, and she does such a phenomenal job. They have sued the American Board of Internal Medicine and the OBGYN Board and the Family Medicine Board. I think there may have been one other for their abuses. And I am so optimistic that this is going to lead to an awareness. Of course, we want those who have been guilty of wrongdoing to be punished appropriately. But this is going to hopefully allow our profession to go in a different direction than we have been over the last generation or two, because we have revealed our heart the last two and a half years. We are a corrupt profession. Our hope and prayer is that we would repent individually and as a group and go get back to the ethical, moral, principled perspectives of this wonderful opportunity and the profession that you and I and millions of others have had in the last in America. And just hope that we can, this would be a wonderful starting point for reevaluating who we are and what we do. I'm optimistic we will.
I will end with this. Again, this is Dr. Jordan Vaughn, Dr. Stuart Tankersley, but the wonderful thing about at least the current America that we have is that we have the ability within the judicial system and within the legal system to right the ship. And what that means is we can call these people out, even though they have done incredible wrongs. They don't go into darkness, and instead they can be brought to light and shown, and not as an example, but instead as a reminder that our system works, that eventually these bodies, these administrative people who in the cloud of fear or the fog of war were doing wrong, that wrong can be exposed and it can be righted in a way that it won't happen again. So that goes back to, again, this hopeful silver lining, the thankful part of where we are. That system doesn't exist in a lot of other Western countries. And I think we are unique in that aspect. And it's one of the reasons that we have to continue every day to fight to be a society that allows open discourse, allows people to have fundamental rights that when they're violated have to be accounted for. So again, I want to thank everyone for joining us today, and we will talk with you next time. Again, this is Dr. Jordan Vaughn, Dr. Stuart Tankersley, ConcernedDoctors.org on America Out Loud Pulse, always one beat ahead.